Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, more than 4,000 Haitians came to Massachusetts after the devastating 2010 earthquake. Now, under a Trump administration ruling, they're facing deportation. And the White House cybersecurity czar says it's time for businesses to work together to fight hackers.
Today, I think that defense has to be perfect every day. And those who would seek to do us harm or steal our things only have to be successful once.
Also today, unconventional advice to medical students. Get a therapist.
You are your most important patient because we need you to be healthy.
Plus, remembering JFK 100 years after his birth.
Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. More than 4,000 Haitians living in Massachusetts are facing deportation. That's because the Trump administration announced today that it will terminate their temporary protected status in January 2018. Roughly 50,000 Haitians were enrolled in the Temporary Protected Status Program, or TPS, following the massive 2010 earthquake that destroyed much of Haiti. And since then, the Obama administration had been renewing TPS every 18 months, citing continued miserable living conditions across Haiti. The next TPS renewal was set for July 22nd, but the Department of Homeland Security says it will not renew the program, but it will allow 6 additional months for a, quote, orderly transition, meaning deportations could begin on January 22nd, 2018. Joining us now with reaction is Massachusetts State Senator Linda Dorsino-Forey. Senator Forey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here on Radio Boston.
Also with us is Susan Church, chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Susan Church, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
First of all, Senator Forey, I mean, your constituents include a huge number of the Haitian population, the Haitian community here in Massachusetts. What's your reaction to the Department of Homeland Security's announcement today?
I mean, I'll say that obviously, yes, tomorrow's the deadline in terms of, but the expansion of 6 months, you know, this is something that USCIS recommended, and we're calling on USCIS really to revise their recommendation to Secretary Kelly. We think it's very important. Obviously, under the previous administration, expanding and extending every 18 months made sense in light of the earthquake. Haiti's not quite stable in terms of rebuilding to be able to capture these 50,000 people to coming back to the country.
Mm. Well, I mean, as you know, Secretary Kelly released a statement today saying he believes pretty much the opposite. He said, quote, the Haitian economy continues to recover and grow, and 96% of people displaced by the earthquake and living in internally displaced persons camps have left those camps. Even more encouraging is that over 98% of those camps have been closed. Is that good enough for you?
I mean, it's not good enough. I think one thing that our government is obviously not taking into consideration is the multiple hurricanes that have hit Haiti. I'll also say the cholera that's in Haiti continues to devastate Haiti through the different hurricanes in the waters. You know, the impact is really severe. And I would say, I'd beg to differ and say that there are still folks living in camps from the earthquake. And we need to do a better job in terms of working this country that's our neighbor, right? Only 600 miles from our shores off of Florida, to see how can we help them truly rebuild this country so folks are able to go back. But in 6 months, really, they're not going to be able to capture and reintegrate these people.
Susan Church, I mean, we're talking about 4,000 people here in Massachusetts, but more than 50,000 Haitians in the program overall. I mean, what are their legal options now?
Well, that's part of the problem is that, you know, this administration has said for time and time again that they're targeting the people who are not good for our country. But these are groups of people who work hard. They contribute over $280 million to Social Security, to our economy. And many of them are married to U.S. citizens or have U.S. citizen children and given the right amount of time could eventually adjust to lawful permanent residence status. But if this time frame of 6 months is so short, that would cause them some difficulties in doing that.
Well, let me just jump in right here. I mean, regarding those children who are U.S. citizens, born U.S. citizens, in many cases, what's likely to happen to these families then?
That's an incredible difficult decision that my clients face all the time. Do I bring my children to a country that is ridden with cholera, that's been struck many times by earthquakes, that its own government says it doesn't have the capacity to take them back to Haiti? Or do I leave them here and have them stay with aunts, uncles, cousins, distant cousins? It's an incredibly bad and ill-fated decision that they have to make to decide what to do for their families.
Mm. Linda Dersina-Fori, you know, earlier this month there was that report from the Associated Press that found that USCIS and the Department of Homeland Security were looking into the Haitian community as a whole to try and see if, you know, criminal records of any immigrants or if any TPS recipients were gaining benefits from the United States, which they're not eligible for. I mean, are members of the community, were they then and are they now concerned that they're being unfairly targeted?
Well, I think that is the problem, right, in terms of the lens and the atmosphere in our country right now, is that there is this sense of being an anti-immigration lens, right, or an anti-immigrant lens. And I think it's very unfortunate because we know our incredible country. We know America is based on compassion and generosity. But this is a country that's been built by the contribution of immigrants from all backgrounds. And so, you know, to pick on this particular group of people and other groups as well, you know, through this administration is just wrong. And so we're happy that Secretary Kelly has expanded this for 6 months, but this is what USCIS recommended in the first place. So we need to call on USCIS to revise their recommendation to Secretary Kelly. And we need to call on Secretary Tillerson, because the Department of State was supposed to also do a report. And so we need them, you know, really to do their part and to go to Haiti and go take a look at this country. But as Susan said, thank you for all your work with these families. But, you know, these are American children, right, that are born here, that are going to be separated from their parents. It's wrong. And on all levels, it's wrong. And so we're asking our government to do the right thing and extend TPS by 18 months. And that's what should happen.
But, you know, a lot of people say that the renewal after renewal after renewal from the Obama administration, now you're calling for another one. I mean, it sort of undermines the entire temporary portion of the whole meaning of the temporary protected status program, Senator Fori.
I mean, I'll say this. You know what? There's several countries that have TPS, okay, since there's about 13 countries now, including Haiti, really 12, I guess, because I think Liberia was taken out of it or it expired. But I say that, you know, it is about temporary. I mean, I'm going to say in terms of Haiti in particular, you know, there are serious conditions in Haiti that does not allow for 50,000 people to be reassimilated into the country. Earthquake is one. Everyone talks about the earthquake. Susan just mentioned again the hurricanes, multiple hurricanes after another. You know, these storms, these landslides that are taking place because of deforestation, right? Because people are so devastated in terms of cutting trees so they could create coal to cook. You have UN that has finally taken responsibility for bringing cholera to Haiti. There was never cholera in Haiti. Mm. They've committed to $400 million promise, but only $12 million has been raised, right, to put into water infrastructure, to put into helping families who are deceased. And so there's a lot going on the ground. Mm-hmm. And to say you're going to separate families and leave children here without parents, you know, doesn't make sense. And the whole criminal aspect, you know, it's always scapegoating, isn't it? Oh, wow, all these Haitians with TPS are criminals. Oh, geez. You know, I echo Susan that the Haitians who are here are working extremely hard to get TPS where they are able to work legally and send money back to Haiti.
Well, Senator Fori, I'm sorry to cut you off here, but I want to turn back to Susan Church before we run out of too much time. I mean, pick up on, if you could, Susan Church, what Senator Fori was saying. I mean, for example, Haitian immigrants make up quite a large number of workers in certain aspects of healthcare here in the state. And what impact could this decision have?
Right. So what's important to understand is anyone with TPS does not have a significant criminal record. The laws are very strict about TPS. Anyone who has it has to be re-fingerprinted each time it's renewed every 18 months. So when they started looking for criminal activity, these immigrants, I doubt they're going to find it because they would have lost their status already. The rules are very strict. As far as the impact, Haitians are disproportionately involved in Massachusetts in particular in elder care activities. They do home health care. And it's just a product of where they, you know, their friends get them a job, a friend gets them a job, so they get overly concentrated in one industry. I really have to wonder, who's going to care for these individuals now? Who's going to take care of the 89-year-old grandmother at minimum wage? These are not jobs that Americans are banging down the doors to take.
You know, Secretary Kelly said in his statement today that, you know, we have between basically now and January 22nd, 2018, so 7 or 8 months, for Haitians to apply for other immigration benefits, which they may be eligible. And you're saying that's not enough? 7 months isn't enough time?
No. For example, if you're married to a U.S. citizen, what you would need to do to get your green card if you entered without a visa initially is travel outside of the United States and come back and get entered and inspected if you're not in one of two circuits that allow you to not have to leave. That process alone takes anywhere from 10 months to a year, just the first part of it. Then after that process, you're talking about another 6 months to a year, and especially with the backlog these days of the rush of people trying to regularize their status because of this administration. Mm. So it's not a fair timeline, and it's not enough time. And where, again, I think the real question is, where are these children going to go? We're going to leave them here, we're going to orphan them here, or our U.S. citizens are going to be going back to live in a country that's overwhelmingly poor and unstable.
Senator Foy, we're running out of time here fast. We just got under a minute to go, but I want to read you a comment from a listener who commented on a previous story about the Haitian community or the Haitians under TPS, and get your reaction to it, because I think a lot of people might feel this way. The person wrote to us at WBUR that at some point, temporary status needs to live up to its name. Folks have had the opportunity to massively out-earn their counterparts back in Haiti, and they may very well be the best hope for Haiti to rebuild. I'm just wondering what your response to that for many people who say it is time for these Haitians to go back and maybe, you know, be equally contributing members to Haiti as a nation as they have been to the community here in Boston.
Okay, I'll just say this and be done, is that basically in terms of, according to the U.S., you know, it costs for these TPS folks are raising about $460 million in taxes, you know, here for our country. But more importantly, this TPS and them being here has allowed them to work to send back about $1.4 billion in remittances. So when folks think that there is an economy in Haiti, but is it enough to hire 50,000 people that are coming back? We say no. You know, these folks, as Susan said, there is an economy there, but it's not strong enough for these folks to go back to Haiti and to work. And so I do think that once Haiti is stable, which it is not, and that's where we need our country to play a role to extend TPS by another 18 months, and then to really help and helping the Haitian government, you know, to stabilize and to build capacity. And that is something that is missing. And once we're ready to have that conversation and do right by this country, then I say we need to extend TPS until we make sure that it is truly stable before we're sending our American children to go live in a country that they're not able to assimilate to.
Well, Linda Dorsina-Forey is a Massachusetts state senator. Senator Forey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Susan Church, chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Next week marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of President John F. Kennedy. His short time as the 35th president was marked by turmoil both inside the country and with other nations. All this week, WBUR is examining Kennedy's legacy in his home state of Massachusetts. And today, we wanted to revisit Kennedy's inaugural address. As WBUR's Kelly Horan reports, the new president delivered a Cold War message to a nation under nuclear threat.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace.
Kennedy's inaugural address is one part Cold War speech, one part domestic agenda.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us, instead of belaboring those problems which divide us. Let both sides, for the first time, formulate serious and precise proposals for the inspection and control of arms, and bring the absolute power to destroy other nations under the absolute control of all nations. Let both sides seek to invoke the wonders of science instead of its terrors. Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce.
By all accounts, Kennedy galvanizes his audience, but he tempers their expectations as well.
All this will not be finished in the first 100 days, nor will it be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But let us begin.
Kennedy reportedly told his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, that he wanted this inaugural speech to be as enduring as Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. As he draws to a close, he makes a spontaneous change to the text, assuring that that will be the case.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Excerpts from President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, given on January 20th, 1961. The story was produced by WBUR's Kelly Horan with help from George Hicks. It originally ran as part of a WBUR series called November 1963. To hear that full series, go to our website, radioboston.org. Back in a moment, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's an inherent problem when it comes to cybersecurity. If you're a business, say like a utility company or a hospital or a bank, and you get hacked, how much of that information do you share? I mean, companies are always loath to share any sensitive information or intellectual property, especially with competitors. But on the other hand, sharing exactly that information could lead to better preparedness for the entire industry when it comes to cybersecurity. Well, that's the idea behind CyberUSA, a nationwide consortium of public and private companies hoping to share information about current cybersecurity threats. Today, the local branch of this new group, CyberMass, launched with the endorsement of the White House cybersecurity czar, Rob Joyce.
Today, I think that defense has to be perfect every day. And those who would seek to do us harm or steal our things only have to be successful once.
Well, joining us now is Phil Bond, Executive Director of CyberUSA. He's also former U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce and Technology under President George W. Bush. Phil Bond, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So give it to me in a nutshell. What exactly is CyberUSA hoping to accomplish that isn't going on now between businesses and industries?
Right. We want to do two things fundamentally. One, we want to make sure that all of the cyber communities across the United States, every state, every community that has a focused group is aware of the latest. That could be the latest policy. That could be the latest grant opportunities at the federal government. But we want to make sure they're fully informed. And so we'll be creating content from Washington, D.C., sharing with all the affiliates. They share it with the companies and academic institutions that are members of theirs. So that's one. The second, though, is to get them all on the same threat sharing platform so that we can begin sharing incidents and shortening the time to remediation.
Okay, so give me an example of, in an ideal world, then what would that what would that threat sharing platform and what would come out of that?
Sure. Perfect example is the recent headlines around WannaCry, the ransomware. So wherever that would have hit first, you could have looked in your local community, like here in CyberMass, and they would have said, gee, somebody else has that in my community. How did they fix it? Or if they didn't find it, they could, in the CyberUSA system, they could say, gee, did they find that in Texas? Did they see it in California? Have they seen it anywhere else in the country? And if so, how do we remediate that? So you get to a much quicker, it's in effect crowdsourcing these problems in your community, but then also nationally.
So then let's go straight to the conundrum here, right? Okay. Because oftentimes in the process of sharing that information, companies are or should be or would be concerned that they'd be revealing the vulnerabilities in their own sort of cyber infrastructure, for example, and they don't want to do that.
Right. Absolutely, they don't want to do that because that could make them more vulnerable and it would make them vulnerable to their competition who might exploit that. So the magic of the system is that you anonymize on the edge. All you know, for instance, here in the enclave in Cyber Massachusetts called Cyber Mass, you only know that somebody else in this region has that. Uh-huh. You don't know who. So it's anonymized at the edge. Even the company who wrote the software and runs the system, they don't know exactly who entered that threat. So you're anonymized on the edge and protected from that. And the other thing you get is you get some protection from liability suits because Congress, recognizing that we need more sharing, has actually said if you join a sharing organization, you get some liability protection in the event of a suit. So there's incentives, and now there's no longer this fear because you're anonymizing, so you don't have to worry about people exploiting that.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so anonymizing and liability protection, yes. Two really important parts. So here, okay. I mean, you have private sector experience too, right? I mean, you worked as director of federal public policy for Hewlett-Packard.
For HP, and then also at Monster.com, a great Massachusetts company.
So are you, I mean, given that, do you think that businesses, industries, I mean, some of these, we're talking about huge companies here, would they be amenable to these ideas?
I think they are. I think the real question is going to be the smaller and medium sized because they're not used to doing this. The large companies participate in what are called information sharing and analysis centers in Washington, connected to the Department of Homeland Security. But those are really just the big companies. And of course, the threats are coming through the doors of the small and medium-sized companies who are connected to the big companies. So everybody knows the case of coming in through, infamously in one case, through an HVAC provider to get into Target's system.
Wow.
So it's not just about the big companies. It's about small and medium-sized. So that was our idea, is that if we can start with local communities, we can get the small and medium-sized companies to participate through the associations and so forth that they're already a part of. In fact, that's what we did here in Massachusetts. Cyber Mass really is a project of Mass TLC, the Tech Leadership Council here, that launched this new effort. So we took some of the leading associations around the country and said, would you join our community of communities? Because we knew that they already had big numbers of companies and a lot of small and medium-sized companies who will trust them.
Right.
To be the place where they meet and exchange incidents.
So let me ask you, because since you mentioned the WannaCry ransomware,
yes.
I mean, that was reportedly made using stolen NSA-linked software, right? So I guess that's another way of me asking, what role does the government itself play in sharing the knowledge that it has and what it knows with industry to help protect industry and companies?
Right. Through the Department of Homeland Security, there's significant sharing that goes on. Same with the FBI, alerting folks when they may have been hacked or otherwise compromised and not know it. So a lot of sharing goes on there. Of course, everybody always wants more. There are some real tough gray area cases where the government itself is wrestling with how do we handle, when do we notify a company about some of those things. And Congress is starting to get in that act as well with some proposed legislation.
Mm. Well, I am curious, though, the WannaCry ransomware, I think it just it demonstrates so many vulnerabilities at once. And maybe we're just starting to get used to them, sadly. But one of them is that, like, the stuff spreads fast. Mm-hmm. It was, just hours, a day even, before we had dozens and dozens and dozens of places that had succumbed to the ransomware. So, I mean, even if we have these new collaborative and information sharing endeavors, does it really matter since the speed of these viruses and these attacks is so fast?
Right. They're automated. They're very fast. But I think right now you can make a really good case that the bad guys collaborate and coordinate 24/7. and the good guys not so much. Mm-hmm. So if we can shorten that time a little bit and do a little bit more coordination and collaboration, we would have shortened the impact of WannaCry. The silver lining on WannaCry, I think, is this. Companies have always been really hesitant to admit that they were held ransom, because you have to admit that first you were breached and then you were blackmailed.
Yeah.
You know, not something I want to raise my hand to say, yeah, I did that. But maybe now, because this was so widespread and touched so many people, maybe we're over that a little bit and people will start to bring in officials and others who can help.
Yeah.
Because silence just guarantees that the ransomware guys come back and try to hit you again.
Mm. Well, so if I could just loop back for a second to something you were talking about, the smaller and medium-sized companies.
Yes.
Because, you know, the big players have the incentive and the economic means to do whatever they can to protect themselves. But maybe the incentive exists, but the economic means for smaller and medium-sized companies may not exist. I mean, is there a role for coming up with economic incentives to get companies to patch, to fix vulnerabilities, to do what they can do to protect, you know, their little corner of industry?
Right. I mean, there are some. That's what Congress is trying to get at with this protection offered on liability if you're in a sharing organization. But for the small companies, it's life and death. I mean, it's pretty good incentive that your company could go away. What we're trying to address is that they have smaller staffs. They're not going to have a full-time security officer and these kinds of things. So let's, in effect, crowdsource it in a community and see if we can't get some of the bigger companies helping, because they have an interest. Those are their vendors and their supply chains who are being infected, the smaller companies. So they have an interest. So let's see if we can kind of look at the community interest to act together rather than just the individual interest.
Yeah, and maybe we shouldn't go and presume that the largest players are going to do their part automatically. And I want to just play to that point a little bit of tape from White House Cybersecurity Coordinator Rob Joyce this morning. He talked about the difficulties of investing in cybersecurity, and he actually used hospitals as an example.
If you can invest in replacing all the Windows XP machines throughout a hospital, do you do that, or do you hire three additional doctors? It's a hard trade, and I think there'll be discussions after the recent ransomware as to where they set that needle.
So Phil Bond, I mean, it is indeed a hard trade, but I mean, I'm going to guess that you would recommend that they invest in their cyber infrastructure for the long haul.
Well, fundamentally, yes. But another point Rob Joyce made this morning is there's never going to be 100% perfect defense. So it is always a choice of how much risk you're going to accept. How much risk in the healthcare case am I going to accept on the cyber front versus the risk of losing patients. So you're constantly weighing these risks, trying to pick the right level so that you don't have 100% cyber defense, but you have defense for the highest risk, highest cost cases. That's the kind of tough choice that everybody has to make. You do that even in your personal with your PC, how much time and effort you're going to invest in that. You could buy 20 different programs to protect your PC, but really, is that worth it? So everybody's making those risk choices. We're just trying to elevate that and maybe help them by bringing a community around them to say, you know, you're not in this alone.
Well, Phil Bond is the executive director of Cyber USA. He's also former U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for Technology. He was served in that position under President George W. Bush. Phil Bond, thank you so much for coming in today.
Great to be here. I can't wait to hear the Celtic news.
Well, we're going to get to that Celtic news in just a second. Phil Bond was teasing the fact that sitting next to him is Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Actually, you know what? Let's not make people wait. We're going to talk with you about something else entirely, Shira. But let's talk about the Celtics right now first.
For Phil, who grew up, he tells me, grew up in California, but is a hardcore Celtics fan.
I grew up in Southern California watching the Lakers and rooting for the Celtics.
Shows you the influence of the green, right?
And so we know how Phil feels about the game. How do you think? Do you think that they're going to survive for to the end of the series?
Do I think they're going to win the series? Is that the question?
Well, yeah.
No.
Oh, come on.
Sorry to rain on everybody's parade, but yes, this was one unbelievable, almost mind-blowing game. I mean, you had to have Marcus Smart play out of his mind. Career high, 27 points, 7 three-pointers. I don't think we'll see an encore of that in game 4 or 5,
But
didn't they say the same thing about the Red Sox in 2004?
Yeah, they did. But it's, I think, a little bit of a different kind of animal here. Though I think they might be able to push the Cavaliers to six games. You know, they might be able to get another win in the next two. But let's not forget where we were about 48 hours ago, which was, I think, on the other side of like a historic 44-point loss at the Garden. And then there was, of course, we cannot forget that Isaiah Thomas is done for the rest of the postseason with a right hip injury. And let's, you know, the reason Marcus Smart had an opportunity to have like a career night was because he was taking the place of Isaiah Thomas and sort of getting an opportunity to show what he can do.
Okay. So, Phil, before we usher you politely out of the studio here, I'm going to give you one last shot here. Do you still believe?
I still believe.
Next year, Phil.
This is the franchise of Bill Russell and they're going to do it. Just wait.
Okay, you heard it right here. The executive director of Cyber USA still believes
you can put money on Vegas.
Anyway, thanks again, Phil.
Thank you.
Okay, so Shira, really the reason why we had you in here, other than to give us the straight news on the Celtics, is about a different piece entirely that you wrote for the Boston Globe magazine. You're a woman of many talents.
Many interests.
And talents. And this has to do with the fact that people aren't very good, even if they try to be. They're not great about making decisions that are good for the environment, naturally, right? I mean, like, you can recycle, you can drive a hybrid car, but maybe you still get on an airplane to travel long distances, or you keep buying tons and tons of stuff.
Say, yeah, we're big consumers. We like to just accumulate lots and lots of stuff and fly lots and lots of places and do lots of gas guzzling activities.
Yeah, and so but there's an emerging branch or emerging use of neuroscience to get us to behave better or make better choices when it comes to the environment?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sort of happened in this weird way. I'll give you a little bit of an origin story here, which was I was at a cocktail party and I met this pediatric neurosurgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital named Dr. Tina Duhaime. And we started off talking about concussions, a very sports-oriented thing. And I said, so, you know, normal cocktail party talk, you know, what else do you do in your spare time? She goes, well, I'm trying to work on tapping into the brain's reward system in a way that helps us make better choices for the environment. And I said, ooh, please explain what that means.
Yeah.
And she basically said, you know, we have these impulses, you know, we get these dopamine hits for doing certain things. You know, your brain's reward system kicks into high gear. You know, when, for example, when you eat dessert or something like that.
Or
like,
when you're gambling.
Or when you're
gambling.
I mean, gambling.
The casinos know this
exactly.
really well. Yeah.
Exactly. Gambling, eating sweet stuff, doing, you know, some fun activity that you enjoy, you know, sort of a little dopamine hit. And it could be anything. It could be learning a new skill sometimes. And she says, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could translate that into ways in which you made better environmental choices? And I don't want to say trick the brain, but sort of manipulate your thinking in a way that you are making better choices for the environment and getting that dopamine hit for doing that.
Right. So, I mean, it's harnessing sort of a very natural, deeply ingrained aspect of how our brains
exactly.
work, but, for good, right?
Exactly.
Just doing good. I mean,
exactly.
Give us some examples on how some companies are doing
Yeah.
this.
I mean, so one of the things that kind of gives you a little bit of hit is when you're better than somebody else or sort of your brain gets a nice little dopamine rush from competition. And so whatever source has done, they've tapped into that competitiveness.
Oh, with those letters they're
yes,
sending.
Yes, yes. Have you received those letters? How do you do? Are you okay. average or above
so
average?
So these are
Magna?
These letters that say in comparison to your neighbor, you're
yes.
using less, more, the same amount of energy.
Yes.
And I'm going to say, I'm shamefully going to admit that we're using more than average, but I think I have determined the culprit. We have a really inefficient refrigerator, which is like on all the time and it's big and horrible, but it would cost a lot to replace it. So I think that's the culprit, but we're not doing as well as our neighbors, sadly.
But you do look at those reports.
Yeah, and I feel bad.
Exactly. And so what they found is, so whatever source did is they put those reports out precisely to tap into the natural competitiveness, the brain's rewarding of competitiveness. And they're hoping to change behavior by doing that. And they've actually, I think over the last 3 years that they've sent these reports out, saved around 2% of energy consumption. So they've cut down on energy consumption across their customer base.
Okay, but I'm curious how many materials they use to send out those letters.
Well, I did ask that and they are transitioning to email. So some of them are hard copy, but they are transitioning to email. But to your point about your old refrigerator, what they've also noticed is it sparked an interest in a conversation in their customers to do more. So they have more people contacting them about how can they be more energy efficient to be even better than their neighbors.
Okay, good. So you also, this leads us to another aspect of the piece you wrote for the Globe magazine, where you talked to folks who said we have to also reframe how we even think about or talk about making environmentally conscious choices, right?
Yeah, this is all part of it. And I think another example is an experiment. This was this towel usage experiment, which I thought was pretty interesting, where three scientists went out and they basically asked hotel guests to reuse their towels, but they prompted them in one of two ways. Help save the environment, reuse this towel, or again, tapping into that competitiveness and saying 75% of the guests who stayed at this hotel reused their towels. Join them in helping save the environment. Huh. And that reframing, that subtle shift in language, that comparison helped tap into the brain's reward system.
Okay, but you're at the beginning of your piece. I laud this effort, but what I'm also thinking is that it's a gigantic mountain to climb, because at the beginning of your piece you have example after example of how powerful the in terms of getting stuff, like all the stuff Americans have,
because that's where your dopamine hit is now.
And and quite frankly, we have advertising, marketing, an entire economy that's built around you buying more stuff. You said that the average American household has 300,000 items in it.
Yeah,
300,000.
Yeah, yes, but keep in mind that's from sofas to salad forks.
But you talk to people who are at Target, there to get one thing, and they end up with a shopping cart full of stuff.
Yes, and it is. It's a long slog. This is not something, we didn't evolve to the way we are in 15, 20, 30, 40 years. We evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. So this is a long slog, but it's a little bit of a deeper way of looking at it. I know people have looked at the behavioral aspect of, how can we be greener and make greener choices, but this is really looking at it on a biological level and taking a deeper dive into it. It's going to take time, though, and it's going to take a buy-in from corporations. One of the things that Dr. Duhaime is proposing is a green children's hospital, because she wants to study both how the individual responds to this way of looking, tapping into the brain's reward system for greener behavior, and to study how she can make larger industries like the healthcare industry use it.
What about all those folks out there who say, yes, I'm all for saving the environment, but I don't want to live in a world where my neuroscience, my neurobiology is constantly being manipulated, whether it be through advertising or companies, who are trying to use brain science to change
my
behavior.
But you're already there, right? Aren't we already there? It's just a question of how do you want it to be manipulated? Do you want it to be manipulated for good, or do you want it to be manipulated for evil? Evil being the non-green side of things. Do you want it to be manipulated so that you're leaning toward behaviors that help the environment? I'd say I want myself, I'd like to be manipulated for good. If it's for good, I'm okay with it.
Well, Shira Sprager's article in the Boston Globe magazine is called "Why Is It So Hard to Stop Buying More Stuff?" We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. And as you heard earlier, Shira also knows a thing or two about basketball.
There's a whole green theme here going on with the Celtics and the environment. That's the connection.
She's WBUR sports and society reporter. Shira, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, it is commencement season, and in a moment, we're going to hear some excerpts from some of the best speeches around the region so far. But first, here's a speech you won't hear, but probably should. And here to tell us more is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Meghna. And yes, if anyone you know is graduating from one of the four medical schools in Massachusetts, so that's Harvard, BU, Tufts, or UMass, then this is a speech you might want to share with them. Our headline on Common Health is, "Congrats, med school grad. Now it's time to find a therapist."
Okay, I'm just going to inject an immediate bit of little skepticism here. There are lots of other high-stress careers that would be sound advice.
Yes, absolutely. But you could also say that medical training is uniquely stressful with its long hospital shifts. Like, doctors can work shifts of up to 28 hours starting this summer.
Oh, wow. Okay. So right after graduation. So long hours and, of course, patients who are in dire straits. Mm-hmm. And there's so much to know, so much, literally life and death at stake here. So, yeah, I can see how it's a recipe for mental distress.
It is. And so this speech is by Dr. Elizabeth Poorman. She's a local primary care doctor. She's based in Everett. And she graduated not so long ago herself and did a special project for us last year on how rampant depression is during medical training.
And she had it herself, right?
Yes. And she also talked about waiting to get help for her depression because she felt alone in the severe emotional toll that her training was taking. And she figured her mental state wasn't directly affecting her work performance. Here's a bit from her piece last year.
Our whole lives are work. So as long as you're able to get up and go to work and work these 16-hour shifts and do a good job, which I feel like I was doing at least a decent job, then it's fine. Then it's not a disorder. It's just, you know, some variation of normal life experience.
But, you know, she came to realize that feeling horrible sadness and impotence and terrible fear at work and going home and crying every night and having trouble sleeping, that's just not okay. And she came to find out that she wasn't alone in all of this. In fact, one study found that about 4% of med students are depressed before their internship, and that goes up to 26% during internship.
Huh. So what is Dr. Poorman's advice to that next generation of med school grads?
Well, so first in her speech, she does acknowledge the extraordinary upsides of working in medicine, that while there's so much pressure, there are also these great rewards.
You will know what it means to be the person that someone who is sick and frightened trusts, because you have earned that trust. You will know what it means to walk a family through the death of their loved one, to bring peace to a harrowing and painful experience, which you will transform with your care into a time of loving goodbyes and healing. But those joys will come at a cost to you.
Mm. And that cost, Carrie, is that heightened risk for depression.
Depression and even suicide. In fact, one study found that nearly a quarter of interns had suicidal thoughts. So Poorman argues in her speech that given the risks, a therapist can help young doctors recognize what they're going through and also give them someone to call for help.
Even as you slowly lose touch with friends and loved ones, stop eating regularly, stop exercising, stop leaving the house altogether on your days off, you will tell yourself that you are not sick. Your colleagues will probably echo that sentiment themselves, telling you that these feelings are a normal part of training.
But Carrie, where is the line then between some, I even hate to say this, but some suffering as you're going through this incredibly tense period and the, you know, actual diagnosable mental illness?
Well, so a therapist could help you with that, too. Poorman's point is that it's important to know that mental health disorders during medical residency are very common. Here's how she ends her speech.
You are your most important patient because we need you to be healthy. We need you to take care of America's sick. We need you to fight for them. We need you to demand that our dysfunctional and broken system does better. And you cannot do that if it breaks you first.
So that's basically, sounds like what she's trying to do, speaking out to try and change the system.
Right, and ask for better mental health support for young doctors in training, among other things.
Well, Carrie Goldberg is the host of WBUR's Common Health blog. We have a link to the post by Dr. Elizabeth Poorman, the one we've been talking about. That link is at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, on to actual commencement addresses that were given across New England this weekend. Lots of big names were offering up their pearls of wisdom and inspiration to college grads around the region. And we're going to hear highlights from some of those commencement speeches, beginning with former Vice President Joe Biden. He spoke at Colby College in Maine.
The problem that's going on in the Congress now is we don't tell stories one another anymore. Sounds silly, but I mean it. We don't know each other anymore. When you know somebody's mom has breast cancer, or you know somebody's dad just lost their job, or you know that you got a sister who is sick, it makes it hard to dislike that person. You get to understand and see their humanity.
And when it comes to revealing a guest's humanity on television, there is no more talented person at that than TV star Oprah Winfrey. She spoke to the graduates at Smith College in Northampton yesterday.
You know, the reason why I could talk to over 37,858 people, but who's counting, in individual conversations from every place and station in life is that I figured out early on what Maya Angelou had taught me, and that is we are more alike than we are different. And the most important thing I learned, I want to share with you. I learned it through thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of conversations every day, where I tried to be so fully present with every person, to see them, to hear them.
And Winfrey said she began noticing something, that after every interview during her career, the person interview she was talking to would ask her whether the conversation was okay.
What is that? Why does everybody, including Beyonce, when all her Beyonce-ness, at the end of dancing on stage, hand me the mic and say, was that okay? It's because every person, every argument you've ever been in, every confrontation or conversation, every person just wants to know they were heard. Every argument you have with your friends is not about whatever it is you're arguing about. It's ultimately about, do you hear me? And many of you have even said, when you don't feel you're being heard, can you just hear me? Can you hear me? Can you see me? And could you understand that what I'm saying to you actually matters?
Well, at Tufts University, Kenya Barris said that if you're really going to hear and understand others, you have to hear and understand yourself. Barris is creator of the hit show Black-ish, and he said his first job as a TV writer was actually on a show with a mostly white writing staff.
It seemed like the only time they really actually cared about my voice is when they would ask me questions like, Kenya, how would a black guy say good morning? I would look at them and say, probably like that, dude. That's what I should have said. But instead, I was so happy just to be included in the conversation. I had to make up stuff like, what up, ma? Or goody mo, fam bam. Needless to say, I was quickly fired from that job.
Well, Barris started to write pilots for his own shows about a former male escort turned Catholic priest, or another one about a long-distance truck driver with narcolepsy.
And then after 19 failed pilots, I wrote Black-ish, and I finally got the call. It was going on TV. I couldn't believe it. What made this show different? Then it hit me. Black-ish was about me, about my family, and subsequently, the honesty of that personal story spoke to a lot more people than everything else. All this time, I had been trying to be other people and do what I thought other people wanted to see from me. But in the end, what ended up succeeding was a show that let me be honest and true, and most of all, let me be me. In fact, that attitude is the attitude I tell my writing staff to come in and work with every day. Be yourself. Think you might be a little racist? All good. Don't know if you're a sexist pig or not? Don't worry about it. Homophobic? Okay with me. I tell them to bring all that stuff into work, be willing to share it, come in and be themselves. See, that's where the best stories come from people from different walks of life just talking honestly.
And that honest conversation is exactly the prescription former Vice President Joe Biden believes the nation needs right now. He called on the graduates of Colby College to treat people with dignity and build the bonds of empathy.
Life can't be lived in the self-referential, self-reinforcing, self-righteous echo chamber we build for ourselves online. Living our screens encourages shallow and antiseptic relationships that make it easy to reduce others to stereotypes, to write another human being off as a bad person rather than someone who's just made a really bad decision, a a person on the other side of the negotiating table, the other side of the political debate, a person who doesn't look like you, who lives in a community you've never visited, a person who has a different background or religion than yours. That's not some, they're not some flattened version of humanity, reducible to a collection of parts and attributes. They're a whole person, flawed, struggling to make it in the world just like you. You have to work to ascribe to your opposition the same emotional complexity you find in yourself that you possess.
Compassion, confidence, empathy. The advice for personal growth and national reconciliation given by commencement 2017 speakers this weekend. Last thought today goes to Oprah Winfrey.
You must find a way every day to develop the spiritual muscle that is the interior, that is the deeper I, that is you. You make yourself full so your cup runneth over, so that you live this full, emboldened life with so much to give to others because your cup is running over. You can only do that by taking time to give back to yourself. So I encourage you, take care of yourself. Love yourself. Love fully yourself, because only people who love themselves have enough love to give to the rest of the world as a woman for the world.
The one and only Oprah Winfrey speaking at Smith College in Northampton yesterday. You also heard from former Vice President Joe Biden. He spoke at Colby College, and Black-ish creator Kenya Barris, who spoke at Tufts University. And once again, as always, congratulations to every graduate of the class of 2017. We expect the best. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.